Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Well, happy Mission Accomplished Day. It's May 1st. Happy Beltane. Happy Law Day. This was passed, in, as I recall, back during the Eisenhower administration in order to blunt the effect of May 1 as the communist holiday, and happy International Workers' Day, all these other things, happy May Day. In fact, it's the oldest origins of May Day with the Maypole. I remember, I'm old enough to remember when we actually did Maypoles in elementary school on May 1st. We actually did we had a pole. This was in our little elementary school in Lansing, Michigan. Had a pole, and we would have ropes, and we'd run around the thing, and we'd decorate a maypole. Well, that's considered a pagan ritual and ain't done anymore, at least as far as I know. But today, the anniversary 4 years ago of...
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Now, of course, he had to then immediately tie Iraq into 9/11.
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, happy Mission Accomplished Day and Law Day and everything else. A lot going on here. A lot going on. And as I mentioned, Beltane, a fine thing. The Ian Bishop in the Post, the Washington Post, writing about the rage over the Homeland Hooker limos. This is interesting. There's a tie-in here somewhere, and I'm not sure that any of us know exactly what it is. And so this is the New York Post, not the Washington Post. But this short little story here that raises this issue, a seething Congressman Peter King, that's of New York, lambasted Homeland Security Michael Chertoff yesterday and accused him of gross dereliction of duty. Now, this is from almost a year ago that this story came out, okay? But just, you know, consider where we are now and what we're hearing about with the Washington, D.C. madam. Accused him of gross dereliction of duty for contracting with a prostitute-toting limo company pushed by disgraced former Representative Randy Duke Cunningham. King, chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, went ballistic during a probe into the contract yesterday when a Homeland Security bureaucrat testified that Chertoff was told about Cunningham's role 2 weeks ago but never told Congress. King yells, "I find it disgraceful that Secretary Chertoff, who knew that a convicted felon was at the center of one of the worst scandals ever, which has had ramifications all over the city, has not said a word to us. This is gross dereliction of duty by Secretary Chertoff." And then the New York Post notes, Chertoff's high-profile spanking was King's political payback for giving New York the shaft with massive cuts of anti-terror funds. Was it about that? Or does this somehow have something to do with the New York madam? Or the Washington, D.C. madam, Deborah Jean Palfrey. 130 subcontractors. Thousands, tens of thousands, lots and lots of clients. We'll see. We'll see how this shakes out. Frankly, you know, I'm of the opinion that consenting behavior between adults, whether it involves money or not, should not be the purview of the criminal justice system. And frankly, what this case is demonstrating in my mind is the sheer blatant, out of control, run amok hypocrisy of the entire thing. But so anyway, a lot going on, and in fact, one of the cases against this from New York Newsday, Miss America is going to refuse apparently to testify in a sex sting that she participated in. That's, you know, so it's just strange stuff all around. It's a kid. So anyway, today also immigration rallies. There's a big debate now within the what is sometimes referred to as the illegal immigrant community, sometimes referred to as the immigrant community, whatever. As you know, I don't think we have an illegal immigrant problem in this country. I think we have an illegal employer problem in this country, but that's a whole other discussion. Anyhow, two large demonstrations are planned for Los Angeles County, although some groups are calling for an economic boycott, and a repeat of last year when thousands of students and immigrants said, no, ain't gonna show up for work. Others are saying, hey, wait a minute, by calling attention to ourselves, we may be causing a problem. We create backlash. It gets all the righties out there, et cetera, et cetera. Not a good thing. So also in today's – I just want to share with you here as we start the show. By the way, in our show, in the second hour of our show, Bernard Goldberger is going to be with us, the guy who wrote Bias. He has a new book out about the right and the left, how it's called Crazies to the Left of Me, Wimps to the Right, how one side lost its mind and the other lost its nerve. And we will be discussing that with him. And in the third hour of our program, Keith Ellison will be with us, the U.S. Congressman representing the 5th District of Minnesota, on the discussion of impeachment. And my favorite quote for the month.
The public has spoken. There's four ways to influence a president. And one is popular opinion, the election. Third is impeachment. And fourth is the purge.
Are you seriously talking about contemplating an impeachment of this president?
What I'm saying, there's four ways to influence a president.
And that's one of them.
Is impeachment. And
that's an option that is on the table.
I'm just saying that's one way to influence a president.
Indeed. The Oregon House of Representatives, the Oregon Senate. The Oregon House voted a couple of weeks ago. The Oregon Senate now voting. This is Senate Memorial 1, not specifically on impeachment, but, again, define Bush, asking the legislature to exercise its appropriate constitutional authority to oppose the administration's escalation, et cetera. So we're finding this happening in state houses and all over the country. Also in the news today, Hugo Chavez setting out to cut the supports out from underneath the Bush administration and those right wingers associated with it and ultimately perhaps, the rest of us. And China moving in. This is in today's Wall Street Journal. Interesting piece. David Lujan wrote in Mexico City and Peter Millard in Caracas, Venezuela. How Chavez aims to weaken the U.S., China, to get preference with oil from projects now under state control. Keep in mind, Venezuela is our fourth or fifth largest supplier of oil. Venezuela's leader Hugo Chavez may have more than just nationalism in mind today when he takes control of four large oil projects run by private firms. Today, May Day, Chavez is saying, okay, that's it. You guys, that's our oil under the ground. Many of them U.S.-based, and hands them over to the state. The ceremonies are also part of a larger effort by the self-proclaimed Maoist to help reshape the global oil business by sidelining the U.S. and making China his country's chief strategic energy partner, both as a source of investments and an important client for exports. The Venezuelan leader's goal is to supply China with 1 million barrels a day by 2012, up from 150,000 barrels a day today. As an ex-Army officer said, the United States is a power on the way down, but China is on the way up. China is the market of the future. Excuse me, a Venezuelan army. The U.S., for its part, is likely to remain Venezuela's biggest client for oil in the coming years, they note. Because of Citgo and all that kind of stuff. But Venezuela, Chavez, talking about maybe even selling off the Citgo refinery system. Which brings us to China. And oil. And it's just amazing what's going on with China and oil. And you tie all this stuff together. China's government, Nicholas Zimisca in today's Wall Street Journal, China's government can't agree on how to fix its ailing health care system through private competition or more state services, and has turned to the World Health Organization, the World Bank, McKinsey & Company, and others for advice. Now, I have some familiarity with the Chinese healthcare system because in 1986, I spent the month of November working in a hospital in China, in Beijing, the Beijing International Acupuncture Hospital. They had a program where you could come in and do any – in fact, a good friend of mine lives in New York, a psychiatrist who practices there now, spent 2 years
You could do a month. You could do a year. You could do 2 years. You could basically, my course was learn what acupuncture is. You know, and in the mornings we'd memorize meridian names, in the afternoon go out in the woods and stick needles in people. My friend Pablo was there for 2 years and became a real conscious, competent practitioner at it. I was just curious. But everything was paid for in 1986 by the state. They had a national health care system. They started privatizing it in the late 80s. And now China's experiencing a real problem because they've got all these people who are not getting health care and who are getting sick, and it's actually representing a national public health problem as well as a social problem. They're trying to figure out what to do about it. I'll tell you about the oil on the East Coast right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Mission accomplished, horns blare. Mission accomplished, hot air. It went without a flaw, the shock filled them with awe. The evil do is done, like burgers on a bun. Mission accomplished, God bless. Mission accomplished, B.S. Yeah, Rumsfeld, he was right. The world is black and white. Mission accomplished, that's right. Hey, who said war is hell when you're friends with Bechtel and Halliburton's boy?
The Minis is your toy.
Be you on the UN.
We won't need them again.
The French are freedom fried. Old Europe, step aside. Mission accomplished, time bomb. Mission accomplished, like none. We came to liberate.
My fellow Americans,
Iraq's a brand new state.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Indeed. So the question, in my mind, the question, the larger question here, ultimately becomes one of the coexistence of, you know, the future of democracy, the coexistence of democracy and unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism. How does this tie in with oil? How does this tie in with healthcare? Let's get into this whole thing. Here, capitalism and dictatorships can coexist. There are people on the right who suggest that Hugo Chavez is some sort of a dictator. I mean, here you have the Wall Street Journal today calling him a Maoist. Now, yeah, I'm not going to go there. My sense of it is that he's more of a... I don't even want to characterize him because frankly, I don't think that the jury is in. But the point is that nationalizing the oil is going to create a problem for the United States, because our private oil companies are deciding our oil policies. Our energy policies in the United States are largely under the control of forces outside the control of we the people, because we have not been exercising democratic oversight over them. And again, in China, here we have China with the healthcare system. They're trying to figure out what to do with their healthcare system. There's an interesting graph of today's Wall Street Journal shows in 87, the majority of healthcare in China was paid for with state funding. By 1991, the majority was paid out of pocket. State funding began collapsing. Why? Because China started moving in this more laissez-faire direction. You can have dictatorship and laissez-faire capitalism at the same time. I remember when I worked in the Beijing hospital, in the hospital in Beijing, the people who came in to see us, they had these little tiny pieces of paper, the yuan, but it was the domestic yuan, and it was literally like the size of a postage stamp. It was about 2 inches long and about a half inch high. It was just a little piece of paper that was like you could buy a meal with it. It was worth, you know, in terms of purchasing power, probably a dollar. You know, I mean, you could buy like a bowl of soup or something like that. And that's what they would pay to come into the hospital. That was like the copay. And for some people, that was a day's wage or a half a day's wage, but it was still, that was the copay. And then everything else was paid for. It was paid for by the state. And the U.S. dollar had incredible power. As I recall, I paid $265 a week to be there to have one-on-one a doctor training me, one-on-one a translator with me, I shared a room with three other people, two docs from Japan and a psychiatrist from Colombia, Pablo, my friend who lives in New York now, and food and room and board. I mean, the whole thing, $265 a week for a month. It was incredible. So anyhow, the Chinese now are trying to figure out what to do. So they went to the World Bank and they said, what should we do? How do we do this? In fact, they're asking private consultants to come in and tell them, how do they organize a healthcare system? The World Bank has been divided on the solution to the problem, according to the person who's seen a draft of the bank's recommendations. This is from today's Wall Street Journal. There are two minds in the World Bank, this person said. One group says you should use more competition. That's the laissez-faire group, right? Bush represents it well.
If it feels good, do it. And if you got a problem, blame it on somebody else.
Yeah. The libertarian group, as it were. And the other says, the person said, recognizes that in remote village settings, there's often only one clinic or doctor who can provide care. So competition in some cases is difficult to foster. Right. So here we have. Now the flip side, by the way, of what Chavez is doing, Chavez is saying, okay, this oil belongs to us. Now the Bush administration is saying, well, okay, we've got a bunch of oil off the East Coast of the United States. Let's give 37% of the revenue from this to the states. In other words, let's say this oil belongs to us and let the private companies come in and drill for the rest of it. We'll help underwrite them with these billions of dollars in welfare that we give these private companies. And in fact, it looks like he's going to jumpstart this whole thing. In the apparent effort to weaken opposition to offshore drilling for oil and gas, the Department of the Interior will allow exploration of potential reserves off the Atlantic coast using seismic equipment. Evidence of substantial reserves could increase the incentives for coastal states to push for the lifting of moratoria on drilling. That from John Fialka in today's Wall Street Journal. And meanwhile, guess who has been singled out by Human Rights Watch? Human Rights Watch, you know, they look all around the world at who are the worst abusers of human rights, and they have just come out with a 210-page report, the most comprehensive analysis to date, on one of the groups, one of the institutions that that Human Rights Watch is looking over, and it's Walmart, a violator of human rights, according to Human Rights Watch. 27 minutes past here.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
The hour on the listener supported radio here at the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, the organic wine company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE, organic French imported wines, and of course, the sponsors that you hear on your local stations. Help them out. Patronize their products and keep Progressive Talk Radio on the air. Chinese workers say they added melamine to pet food. Now, this is what happens when you have this absolutely nutso conservative economic idea that all commerce should be absolutely unregulated. That we don't, you know, that the only purpose of government is to protect us, that the only purpose of government is to field police and armies, and everything else is something called big government and wasteful spending. And it's not an exaggeration. I mean, that really is the conservative worldview. And it's being played out in China. And this, increasingly, this from the New York Times News Service, is U.S. food safety regulators head to China to investigate how a chemical made from coal found its way into pet food that killed dogs and cats in the United States. Workers in this heavily polluted northern city, this is Jiangqi, openly admit that the substance is routinely added to animal feed as fake protein. It looks like protein in tests, even though it does not provide any nutritional benefits, according to melamine scrap traders and agricultural workers here. There's an entire industry in selling melamine, which is a byproduct of burning coal in coal-fired power plants. They've got all this. It's waste. It's you know, toxic sludge is good for you. Remember the Sheldon Rampton's book and John Stauber's book? They have fewer people inspecting products at the ports than ever before, says Carolyn Smith DeWall, the director of the food safety for the Center for Science and Public Interest in Washington, D.C. In recent years, for example, China's food safety scandals have involved everything from fake baby milk formulas and soy sauce made from human hair to instances in which cuttlefish were soaked in calligraphy ink to improve their color. Now, meanwhile, American companies are no longer American, one of the reasons why the stock market is going up. Joe Del Bruno, writing for the Associated Press, the slumping dollar has become a financial lifesaver for U.S. companies whose overseas operations, in many cases, are growing faster than their domestic units. Companies like Caterpillar, McDonald's, General Electric, better than expected results from Europe, Latin America, and Asia. The dollar fell Friday to an all-time low against the euro. But these companies, this is Octavio Marinas, or Marenzi, a chief executive and business consulting group, Celent. He says, what these companies are earning outside the U.S. is worth a lot more. It's like getting a free ride in the currency movement. You talk about Caterpillar. They had a better result than Wall Street was expecting, in large part because of a sales surge outside the United States that pushed overall revenue to $10 billion. Biggest slice of GE's business came from overseas, where revenues rose 9% to $19.6 billion. In fact, Mr. Howard Silverblatt, who is a senior index analyst at Standard & Poor's, S&P, says the amount of foreign sales for S&P 500 companies. Now, listen very carefully to this. We're talking the 500 largest companies in the United States for all practical purposes, the Standard & Poor's 500 companies. The amount of foreign sales is 48.5% of revenue. These are no longer American companies. They note in the article, this is exactly the reason why most stock pickers have advised snapping up shares of companies that do business outside of the U.S. Why? Because we the people have no longer, you know, since Reagan came into office basically for 26 years, have no longer been exercising our power, our authority to say, if you're going to do business in our country, you're going to do it in a way that benefits the workers and that benefits our economy as a whole, not that simply makes multi-billionaires and multimillionaires out of a small handful of CEOs and stockholders and members of your board of directors and basically screws everybody else in the United States. From our energy policy to our health care policy, which China now has been emulating and maybe moving away from, we'll see, to our energy policies, which are being influenced this very May Day by Venezuela, to Bush and his war in Iraq, you know, the place where all this mind bought, well, as Dick Cheney said.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. So all of this stuff together. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Len. What's up?
You know, I was just watching on C-SPAN while you brought up energy, Larry Craig talking about, you know, oil, needing to find oil. And the biggest problem with a lot of with all this has been mergers and consolidation that have really gone unchecked. And, you know, the best example is in the refinery business, where, you know, the cost of gas right now is $3, over $3 a gallon. Now, if you multiply that out by 40 gallons to a barrel, that's $120, which is almost double the price. There's a $57, $55 spread from the cost of a barrel of oil till it gets to your pump. And that's because of the consolidation in the refinery business, where they close refineries. So,
well, really, go ahead.
Really, mergers and consolidations, you know, and allowing, in fact, the scariest news this morning on TV was that Rupert Murdoch just made an offer for Dow Jones and Company. And, you know, talk about narrowing the propaganda mind.
Yeah, it's time to bring back the Sherman Antitrust Act. It's absolutely time to bring back the Sherman Antitrust Act. Reagan stopped enforcing it in 1982-83, which led to the mergers and acquisition mania, the whole Michael Milken thing, all these M&A multimillionaires, and boom, it was the beginning of the end for the economy of this country. And it is time to say, enough already, time to bring this thing back. Walter in Warren, Michigan. Hey, Walter.
Hi, Tom. It's a real pleasure
Hi.
To talk to you.
Well,
I always
you
enjoy
calling.
Your program, and I learn a lot every time I turn on your program. I was surprised to find out that the oil agreement in the Iraq accountability bill is in there. Who put that in there? Why is it in there?
Because we have this diversity in the White House. We have two oil industry CEOs as president and vice president. We're surprised that Bush goes to war in a place where there's more oil than any place else on the planet. Go ahead.
Who do you think was instrumental? I mean, is this the Democrat, the corporate Democrats that did this? I was really surprised the other day to hear that it was in there. Now we're saying if you don't approve this, they're going to pull the troops out? This is really funny to me. I mean,
I am appalled by it as well, Walter.
Okay, good.
I am appalled by it as well. And you know, this is part of the looting of Iraq, frankly. My guess is that it was put in there in order to get support from all of the Democrats and hopefully some of the Republicans.
That's what I thought.
It was probably, you know, part of the horse trading that went on, particularly in the House of Representatives, to get the bill through in the first place. But I'm appalled by it, just like you are, and think that, you know, we need to call it out. On the other hand, and we say these are the benchmarks. On the other hand, those benchmarks are not absolutely binding upon the Iraqi government, at least as I understand the bill. And the Iraqi parliament has a couple of months to figure out whether or not they're going to go with this oil bill and do these so-called PSAs, production sharing agreements, where basically, unlike virtually all the other countries in the Middle East who have gone down the road that Chavez is going down right now, where they say, wait a minute, this is our oil, we own this oil, we get to make decisions about it, Iraq is going to be saying, no, it's really not our oil, it belongs to Chevron or ExxonMobil or whatever. And, you know, just not a good thing. Jason, Arcata, California. Hey, Jason, about a minute before we got to take a break. What's up?
All right.
Jason?
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. How's it going, Tom?
Fine. What's up?
I just wanted to voice, I just called Nancy Pelosi's and I asked for impeachment. I think it's disgusting and despicable that this war continues and we're not funding our education. The school I go to, Humboldt State University, is the only rural California state university, and we're not getting funded adequately, and they want us to double the size of our university while Schwarzenegger wants to build a $10 billion execution prison.
And in the meantime, the cost to the average taxpayer in the United States, just of so far what we've spent on the war, is about $5,000 per taxpayer in the United States. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. When we come back from the break, I want to share with you some of the overall costs of the war, and we'll continue to take your calls here. 45 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. You can drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. Click live chat up at the top in the center of the page. Drop in and say hi. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Stick around.
You
truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
$563,000 have been spent so far in Iraq. That's enough money, according to CostOfWar.com. That's enough money to have provided full four-year scholarships at public universities to 20,452,909 American students. 20 million. The $421 billion that we've spent so far in Iraq is enough to have paid for it a full year of Head Start for 55,881,148 children. 55 million children. A full year of Head Start. I mean, this is mind-boggling. With the money that we have spent in Iraq so far, we could have hired 7 million school teachers. Public school teachers for a full year, 7 million of them, with benefits and everything, 7,311,652 teachers. You say, well, what about public housing? We could have built 3,798,838 public housing units. We could have housed 3.7 million people or 3.7 million families. Robbie in Memphis, Tennessee, listening on WSMB. Hey, Robbie, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just received an email from my aunt, and her suggestion was on the 15th of May, nobody purchased gas. That back
in the
70s.
It'll do no good, Robbie.
I'm sorry?
It'll do no good.
You don't think?
Because, no, it won't do any good at all. Because that's like a heroin addict saying, okay, I'm going to take one day off. Or somebody who smokes cigarettes saying, I'm going to quit for one day, and that's going to make the tobacco companies stop trying to sell me tobacco. We're addicted to oil. And if people take one day and they don't buy oil, the oil companies are just sitting around with a big grin on their face saying, well, you know, they'll just fill up the tank the next day. We need, instead of trying to do something like that at a consumer level, because it just won't work, because, you know, the consumer infrastructure is that, sorry, we're addicted to oil. What we need to do is change our national energy policy. We need to change our national energy policy immediately. We should be looking at what the Germans did 3 years ago, where they went in and they said, okay, everybody, every bank has to give, at a 2% interest rate, has to give a mortgage to any homeowner to build over a 10-year period, a 10-year 2% mortgage to put solar panels on their house. And the power companies have to pay 7 times the going rate to buy electricity back from people from those solar panels, which, by the way, will roughly equal the mortgage payments on the solar panels. So the power companies, by their paying 7 times as much for the electricity, are paying for the cost of the solar panels. Now, why 7 times as much? Because that's the cost over a 10-year period of building a nuclear power plant. So the power companies, at the end of 10 years, have spent just as much money as if they built a nuclear power plant. And they're getting just as much electricity as if they built a nuclear power plant, but instead of getting that electricity from a nuclear power plant, they're getting it from hundreds of thousands of homes' rooftops. And everybody now, the mortgage is paid off, they fully own the solar panels on top of their homes, and the solar panels have a lifespan of 50 years. And then you take a plug-in hybrid car, and you plug it into your house, and you're not driving around on gasoline anymore. I mean, there's so much that could be done so easily. Germany has already done this. JT in Atlanta. Hey, JT, what's up?
Not much, Tom. Appreciate you taking the call. I'm a big Neil Bortz fan down here in Atlanta, and I love listening to your show because you really present an educated opinion, and it's nice to hear, no matter whether I agree with it or not. Just wanted to get your thoughts real quick on our foreign dependency, and it's not, it kind of seems to be a catch-22 where nobody, you know, everybody kind of complains about being hungry for oil and what our business is over in Iraq and this, everything going on with Venezuela, yet still, you know, we can't, the environmentalists, the extreme environmentalists won't even be open to the idea of tapping into our natural resources that we have in our own land. And you can't be mad at another country.
We're already tapping into the resources we have in our own land, JT. About 50% of all the oil we use in this country comes from this country.
But we're not tapping, you know, we're only using a certain percentage of our resources. I know that
we are sucking as hard on that straw as we can. We are hoping that we can find a little bit around the edge. But if we go up in Anwar, for example, and drill up there, we'll get enough oil out of Anwar to supply all of our gasoline needs for 1 year.
Yeah, that's what you're saying about Germany.
It's nothing.
That's all.
It's
good
nothing.
Stuff.
I mean, this is where you mentioned Neil Bortz. You know, I used to listen to Neil when I lived in Atlanta. Neil's a good guy, but he's a libertarian. And you know, his position is government stay out, let the market solve it. The market is not going to solve this problem until you and I go down in flames. This is a problem where we the people need to solve this problem by looking at it and saying, you know, it is time for us to collectively get together and say, yes, you know, it's incredibly profitable for the oil companies to keep us addicted to oil and for the car companies to be in collusion with them and all that. But we're not going to let it happen anymore. We're going to take control of our energy policy here in the United States like other countries have done. Denmark is producing 19% of their electricity from windmills. I mean, this is not rocket science. Chris in Marin County, California. Hey, Chris.
Yo. Oh, you just mentioned Denmark. I heard an interesting characterization of Hugo Chavez's oil policy, and it was exactly comparing with Denmark.
He's doing with oil what they're doing with wind.
No, we're doing with oil what they do with natural gas. They got one of the hugest deposits of natural gas in the North Sea right within their waters. And if you think they're going to let anybody else come in and share in that, you're crazy. It's their greatest asset. That's number one. Number two, if we applied legally the same standards as they use in Europe for mileage, we wouldn't have to import any oil from OPEC.
That's right. You're absolutely right, Chris. And thank you for reminding me of that statistic because it's an important one and it needs to be repeated over and over and over again. If cars in the United States got the same gas mileage that cars get in Germany or in France or in Italy or in England, if our cars simply got the same gas mileage, we would not have to import any OPEC oil whatsoever. And we could say to them, you guys, good luck, have fun, see you later. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back, crazies to the left of me, wimps to the right. One side lost its mind, and the other side lost its nerve. Bernard Goldberg with us, the author of Bias, and the New York Times best-selling author, in fact, of Bias and 100 People Who Are Screwing Up America. Bernard Goldberg, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks very much, especially since I know we don't see certain things in the same light, so I appreciate the civility and the invitation. It means a lot to me. Thank you.
Oh, it is my pleasure. And your website, by the way, BernardGoldberg.com. Bernie, I have to say, I think that you have this backwards. I think it should be crazies to the right and wimps to the left.
I've heard that before, and I understand it. I truly understand it, that from a liberal position, and I should make very clear that, and I mentioned this on page one of the book, that I started out on the left, and in fact,
you still call yourself an old-fashioned liberal.
I do, and that's why the fact that I wound up on something resembling the right, I think it's because the left has moved further and further to the left over the years, and it appears that I'm now on the right. But from a liberal point of view, I totally get what you're saying, and from a liberal point of view, it even makes sense. I'm no longer on that team. You know, I wanted to be on that team. I started out on that team. I don't think any 10-year-old kid takes a list out and checks off how he feels about all the big issues of the day. You are basically how you grew up, and I grew up in a blue collar Democratic family in lower middle class part of the Bronx, and that's what I was. And you know, Tom, I got to be honest with you, I thought I'd always be that. If there's any value in this book for my friends on the left, it's that I think you guys have to understand not how you lost me, who cares about me, but how you lost millions and millions of Americans just like me. That would be of some value.
Bernie, I would submit to you that, you know, having spent some time with your book and with your work over the years, I would submit to you that you never were a liberal and that you're not a liberal now. Yeah, and let me lay this out, and let's just try to define terms here for a moment, because the core liberal worldview coming out of the Enlightenment, from Locke and Rousseau to Thomas Jefferson all the way up to today, is that the fundamental nature of people is good, and that the purpose of government is to backstop us. The primary purpose of government, 5 out of the 6 items listed in the preamble of the Constitution of the United States, is to backstop us, to help each person achieve their greatest potential. The fundamental conservative worldview, which was first laid out by Thomas Hobbes in 1630 in Leviathan, and was followed through, and has followed through, who is quoted extensively by Russell Kirk in 52 in The Conservative Mind, and is still quoted by William F. Buckley, is that the essential nature of people is evil, and that the primary purpose of government is to restrain the intrinsic evil within people, and therefore the purposes of government should be limited to that of police and armies. And those two worldviews, frankly, I think we all need to respect both of them, because we can't objectively prove that either one of them is right or wrong, although I subscribe to the liberal worldview, and what I get throughout reading, you know, what you're saying and what you're doing is that you subscribe to the conservative worldview, is that this country was founded by the children of the liberal Enlightenment. It's traditionally been a liberal country. We have always thought that things like Social Security and unemployment insurance, not always, but traditionally we thought that values like Social Security and unemployment insurance, and I would argue even a national health care system, are things that are desirable. Public education, public fire departments, police departments falls into the conservative purview, arguably fire as well because it's protective. But that all these things are the things that make America great. And conservatives are constantly saying, oh, no, that's big government. That's beyond the scope of government. Government shouldn't be doing that.
Okay. Let me answer that not from a philosophical point of view, but from a practical point of view. The things you mentioned.
And if I could just add very quickly, and then I'll give you, the whole my team, your team thing, it really concerns me, because when it's Democrats and Republicans, I get it, okay? You know, there's talking points on both sides, blah, blah, blah. But when we're talking the fundamental core philosophies that drive decision-making in this country, we should really just be honest about it and lay this stuff out rather than saying, oh, your team's bad, my team's good, or vice versa.
Yeah, but I didn't say your team's bad, my team's good. Here's what I am saying. When I was growing up and my father worked in a factory, he got up before dawn every day to go to a factory that was so damn loud you could go deaf in it, okay? So, and while he was there, I've never gone to private school even one day in my entire life, and that includes 4 years of college at Rutgers University in New Jersey. So I'm certainly for free education. My father cared very much about a minimum wage, believe me. While he worked and when we had food, we weren't anything resembling well off. There was no OSHA back then, but if there were, you know, I guarantee you his factory wouldn't have been as loud as it was. I'm all for that kind of stuff. I mean, you and I probably agree on far more than either you think or than you want to give me credit for. I'm for that kind of stuff. I just don't think government does a whole Social Security. That's a real important one, because later in life, that's how he and my mother, that was a source of income for my parents. So, I mean, I'm not some right-wing ideologue or anything like that. What troubles me, Tom, is when I see, we used to be the upbeat ones. We used to be the optimistic ones. We were on the right side of all the important social issues, starting with civil rights and later women's rights and free speech issues. But I noticed that over the years, it wasn't enough for me to be for civil rights. And by the way, unlike a lot of my liberal friends, I did something in the name of civil rights. I was in college during the height of the civil rights movement. But it wasn't enough simply to be for civil rights and even be for it passionately. Now I have to be for something, whatever you want to call it, it amounts to racial preferences. And I said, I didn't sign on for that. You know, this is the opposite of what Martin Luther King spoke about. He spoke about...
Well, actually, no. Martin Luther King passionately spoke in favor of programs that would affirmative action programs.
He spoke about judging people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin.
You're taking that radically out of context, and you know it, Bernie. I know that Martin Luther King and everybody else, virtually everybody else in the civil rights movement at that time was looking at 300 years, 400 years of institutionalized racism and slavery in this country.
Let me tell you how I got to where I am. Let me at least try to tell you how I got to where I am. That was one of the things that I said. I didn't sign on for that. Call me wrong, whatever you want. I'm telling you, this is what I was thinking.
So, see, that gets to this whole philosophical thing. You're saying the purpose of government should not be to remedy the ills of the past. The purpose of government should be to simply protect people, period.
No. It should be to remedy the ills of the past, but I'm not quite sure why a black kid whose father's a doctor or whose mother's a doctor gets an advantage over a white kid whose father works in a coal mine in Pennsylvania or West Virginia. And I don't think you understand that either, to be honest. I mean, that just doesn't make sense to me. You know, I'm all for reaching out and helping kids. I'm all for providing money for kids who can't afford school. But
the answer is really very simple. The answer is very simple, Bernie. First of all, when those laws were passed, that black kid whose father was a doctor were very, very, very rare, and they're still relatively rare. And as the black middle class has grown, the need for affirmative action obviously has diminished, but there is still a need for that kind of program. I think that we also need to have affirmative action programs that help poor white kids from Appalachia, and actually we have those.
Well, I don't want to get bogged down on this one point, but you know that at many universities. The case went to the Supreme Court, Gratz versus Bollinger, which is the University of Michigan case.
Yeah.
She's a blue-collar girl whose father's a cop, whose mother is like a secretary or something.
I'm familiar with the case. We've debated it to death on
the show. The people listening to us might not be. And black kids got 20 extra points, no matter what their socioeconomic background, simply because they were black, and she didn't. Now, I happen to be on her side on that one, and so was the Supreme Court. But then I move on to women's rights. Hey, I was for women's rights. I still am. But now I also have to be for a policy that says
Bernie, I'm sorry. We only have a half a minute left here, and I get your point, but it just over throughout the book, just like with bias, it seems that you're constantly taking small anecdotes and blowing them out into generalities in order to trash the left, and you never take on the right in a serious way.
Well, I took that's an interesting point. There wouldn't be enough in this book that would make you happy, Tom, unless I took on the right 100% of the time and in exactly the same way you wanted me to. That isn't going to happen, my friend. I happen to have gripes with the left because I was there once and I've evolved and moved to another side, and I have gripes with the right. That's not good enough for a lot of liberals. A lot of liberals want it 100% their way. Sorry.
Oh, you want the right to be stronger. You say that they're wimps. They've lost their nerve.
I think they've lost their way. They've sold out their principles. I think they should be conservative, Tom. Exactly.
BernardGoldberg.com, the website. Crazies to the left, wimps to the right, the book. Bernie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Country, 'tis of thee, but that is what you'll be if you stand in the way of Cheney's war machine. Osama bin Laden, man, where you been? We couldn't find you, so we just went the other way. Go figure. Now we're doing the Bush and Cheney shuffle, a twist on this and a spin on that. I don't believe a single word they say. They just sit around and make up lies all day. They told us Saddam had bubonic plague, WMDs in a bombing place. It was all underground and pointing at the USA. That's what they said.
22 minutes past the hour. May 6th, coming up, the University of Judaism will be presenting the Impact of Talk radio seminar. This year's panel will include me, plus Bill Handel, Doug McIntyre, and Dennis Prager. To register, you can give them a call at 310-440-1246. 310-440-1246. And if that information is not on our website, we'll get it up there. Right spot away. It should probably also, I believe it's also on the KTalk website. It's Los Angeles coming up this next week, next Monday. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Liz in Queens, New York. Hey, Liz, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot. How you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Okay, it was just, I had a comment about the gentleman you were just speaking to.
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah, you're still here.
Okay, he claimed that he was a liberal before mm-hmm. he became a conservative. And listening to him, I could tell he was what I would call a self-centered or selfish liberal, to put it plainly. It was all about, well, my father worked in a factory, so he was interested in minimum wage. I went to public school, so I was interested in public schooling. It wasn't about whether or not other people needed these things. It wasn't about the fact that workers, other side of people who worked in the factory with his father, needed these things. This was my experience, this was my life, and this is why we were what we were then. The selfish liberal.
Well, you know, Bernie Goldberg isn't here to defend himself, and so I don't think that either one of us can psychoanalyze him, you know, from afar or get into it. But I would say broadly, you know, without speaking specifically of Bernie Goldberg, that I think that there are a lot of people who view politics as sports, and I think that that's a pernicious thing in the United States. And they think that they can go from being a conservative to being a liberal, or vice versa, go from being a liberal to being a conservative, simply by taking different positions on the issues. I used to be opposed to affirmative action, now I'm in favor of it. I used to be opposed to national health care, now I'm in favor of it. It's not about the issues. It's about the worldview. It's about understanding what the function of government is, what the purpose of government is. Is government here to backstop us? Is government here to provide for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness on the one hand in the traditional liberal worldview? Or is government here to restrain evil people, to make sure that people aren't having sex with the wrong person in the privacy of their own home, to make sure that people are not taking drugs, to make sure that people are you know, to protect us from the evil out there in the world amongst all those other people? And that's, which is, you know, essentially the conservative worldview. And frankly, I think there's a lot of people running around loose who are calling themselves liberals or liberal Democrats who are actually deep down in their hearts conservatives. And there are a lot of people out there who are calling themselves Republicans. Dwight Eisenhower probably is the most classic example, who would have described himself at the time as a conservative Republican, who actually deep down in his heart was a liberal. And we need to reclaim these words and an understanding of these words so that we can see past the code and we can get past the talking points and issues and really get down to what it's all about. So Liz, thank you very much. I think your point is well taken. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Great teacher that I look up to every day I get a chance.
Okay. That's you.
What's your point?
My point
you called him out.
Okay. Here's a good question. Ask yourself, and I know the answer, and I know what the conservative neocons would say, but I want to hear your answer. Why hasn't the cost of health care and the cost of education deflated in proportion to the majority of the wage workers in this country that have been subjected to globalization and free trade policies. I know.
And really, it's a very simple answer, Armin, and it's actually a really good question, a good technical question. The reason why wages have been going down is because the competition for jobs has been going up. More people are doing the same number of jobs. In other words, we're making shoes in China here instead of here, and we're importing labor for our service economies with employers being allowed to hire people regardless of their citizenship status. The reason why you haven't seen a similar deflation in the cost of health care and the cost of education and things like that is because there hasn't been similar competition. You haven't seen the Chinese coming over here and setting up schools all over the United States. You haven't seen the Chinese coming in and setting up hospitals all over the United States. In fact, if anything, the American Medical Association tries to limit the number of doctors available. Our patent laws allow the pharmaceutical companies to limit the numbers of drugs available and to drive up the prices, even when we pay to do their research. So what we have is a system that works very, very well for those to whom we are giving our dollars, but doesn't work very well to us who want to earn a living. I mean, this is very fundamental. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Traveling coming up Sunday. I think I said Monday. Sunday, I'll be at the University of Judaism in Los Angeles. Sunday, May 6th, the week from Sunday. And then on May 19th, I'll be at KTRC in Santa Fe, New Mexico at 2 o'clock. Doors open at 1:30 at the Greer Carson Theater for a presentation and book signing. Get free tickets, listen to KTRC, and find out how. And on May 17th, I'll be in Denver doing a live show from the Boulder Theater, 9 a.m. to noon Pacific time. Sponsored by KKNZ AM 760, and there's information at their website, am760.net. Kurt in Greenville, South Carolina, welcome to the program, and thanks for listening to WOIC. What's up, Kurt?
Hey, Tom. If it's not too late, I'd like to talk about your Bernard Goldberg segment you just did.
Sure.
Listen, there's a reason why he has his shtick about the liberal media, and is because in the past he could sell a whole lot of books with that line. You know, Murdoch would pick up a, 10,000 or so, get him on the New York Times list, and all the other right-wing welfare billionaires. There is no liberal media bias. None. Zero.
Well, actually, there is. It's right here on this program.
Well, you're right.
I mean, you're right smack dab in the middle, Kurt, of a liberal conspiracy. Here it is. Here, America Radio.
There's not enough liberal bias in the media. That's his shtick. He's sticking to it, and he's going to sell a few books on it. But the fact of the matter is, not anywhere close. Like down here in my local paper, all the editorial columnists are Broder, Cal Thomas, those guys, all of them. We don't have one liberal or moderate in the paper.
Yeah, and you'll find the liberals out there from time to time, and they get picked up here and there. But same thing here in Portland. The Oregonian is, well, it's not all conservative. It's actually 50-50, and they actually strive for that, which I have to congratulate them for that. But a lot of media across the United States is profoundly conservative. Find a newspaper that is profoundly liberal, as many of the profoundly conservative newspapers, like the one that, well, like the Washington Times, for example, that, you know, Reverend Moon runs. Good point. Larry in Lacan, is it Lacana, Washington? Lacana?
Laconner.
Laconner, okay.
Great. Yeah, what's ER. Up, I just want to talk about Bernie. He does a thing that annoys me, to no end, and that's Bernie's basically just claiming victim status. You know, he's just pointing up the limitations of the victim as a political strategy. I mean, the problem with it is not everybody can be the victim. He's saying everybody else has these advantages because they're victims. Well, what about me? And I get tired of the victim strategy, but nobody can seem to come up with what comes next, you know?
Yeah. Well, so, what comes next in terms of what? What do you mean?
Well, as far as rationale for affirmative action or rectifying sins of the past or whatever, and
yeah, I think it's a fairly straightforward process. You slowly phase it out as it's no longer needed. The debate, right? And I think you'll find people in the African American community. You will find people in the African American community who will say that as quickly as anybody else will. The disagreement.
Oh, they understand it. Yes, they understand it quite well.
The disagreement is: are we there yet? And I would say, and I think probably most people in the African American community would say, we still have a hell of a long way to go. And the conservatives are saying, oh, wait a minute, you've got a black doctor over there. Look at that. Everything's fine.
Those are very words.
And everything is not fine. I'm sorry. It's a good point, Larry. Jeff in Shreveport, Louisiana. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, it's an honor. I want to call because I was incensed by that idiot you had on before, and I'm sorry to call names right off the bat. But affirmative action is not what most people who complain about it think it is. Affirmative action, in its strictest sense, only happens after a company has been sued and they've been found to have had unfair hiring practices. And then they go, now you're going to hire so many people for so many years.
Well, what he was specifically talking about was the University of Michigan's policy of giving extra points in the process that they use to determine who's going to come into the school based on race.
Yeah, but the thing about that is, first, that lawsuit. I have on tape Jeffrey Lehman, the dean of that school, saying this. Why didn't that woman sue the white students who got extra points? She only sued on behalf of the black students that did. Mm-hmm. Why did George Bush decide to make his announcement? And normally politicians go, well, I'm not going to comment on an ongoing case. But he commented on this on January 15, 2003. Why? It was MLK's birthday, and there were a whole bunch of right-wingers grumbling that day, and he resonated with them.
He's trying to cleave white from black, right from left in the United States. And the fact of the matter is George W. Bush himself is a recipient of affirmative action. It's an affirmative action program for rich white guys, but it's called the legacy system. You know, if your parents went to the school, you get extra points.
I'm sorry, but I really want to get this in before I go. Mm-hmm. I am 43 years old. Never in my entire life have I been able to check off a box that said, I'm black, move me ahead. Never. In any college I've attended, nowhere. And that affirmative action program, that so-called affirmative action, that's not for every single black student who goes there. That was in that program. Okay, we're going to set aside 1,000 seats, and of those, that's too many there. We're going to set aside 100 seats, and of these 100 seats, we're going to have this special criteria. Now, the black students who were in there, you know, most of those black students in there got in just like the white students. You know, but these whining, you know, angry white males, and don't forget, Newt Gingrich said this in 94. He said that if you're white, you're second, third, fourth in line. That's why we're angry. They do want a victim status. And I am sick and tired of being a scapegoat for that. I am sick and tired of it.
I'm with you, Jeff. And let me just give you what I think may be a little insight into the psychology here. I don't think it cleans it up at all, but what you have in the United States is a lot of people, a lot of white people who were in the middle class or thought they were 30, 40, 50 years ago, whose parents were, who had decent jobs, who had decent factory jobs, et cetera. And as a consequence of 26 years of conservative economic policies, the outsourcing of our jobs, this insane thing called free trade, the destruction of the industrial infrastructure in the United States, what they're finding is that they're no longer the middle class. They're the working poor. And they're scared. They're scared that, one illness is going to destroy them and wipe them out. They're scared that they're one cancer diagnosis away from bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. They're scared that they're one layoff away from, being homeless. And that fear, which is a real and legitimate fear, is being exploited by politicians on the right in order to say, oh, well, let's point out who's responsible for this. And what are they doing? They're pointing at affirmative action. They're pointing at, minorities. They're pointing at liberals. They say that this is the guy. When in fact it's simple economics.
But
that person is thinking, well, you know, my kid can't get into that college, it's this vilification by micro example. When the macro, when the big picture, as you pointed out, the big picture doesn't support these little examples. These are the exceptions that prove the rule, not the exceptions that are the rule. And you said it very well. Jeff, thank you very much for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Good talking with you. Swan in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Swan, what's on your mind today? I'm sorry, Sam.
Hi, Tom.
Hey,
how
Sam,
are
what's
you?
Up? Good.
I had a comment about the upcoming veto, which I guess is taking place tomorrow on the war funding bill.
Yeah.
And the fencing that's going on back and forth between the Democrats and the president regarding adding more things to the bill and timetable and him daring them to cut off the funding in order to force an end to the war.
Right.
And I had an idea that has been met with mixed reviews, and that was, why not just put a clean bill forward to him without the timetable? But what is it, the 21st of January in 2009 when he steps down? How come they don't put in the bill that he goes over there for a year?
There you go, Sam. That's a start. You know, I think that if they're going to just fund this thing, they should do it in 2 and 3 month bites. I mean, that's a very simple. And at the same time, begin some serious investigations. Shram in Royal Oak, Michigan. Hey, Shram, got about a minute before we got to take a break here.
Yeah, hello. First time, I'm a little nervous. And what I'm thinking is that the 2004 election was a practice coup on the part of the right-wingers.
I'd say the 00 election was. The 2000 election was.
What?
I'd say the 2000 election was. That's when it started.
I'm sorry. Your voice is scrambled.
I said I'd say that the 2000 election was when it started, and in 2002, 2004, and 2006, in every case, they've been disenfranchising more people.
Well, I guess they're going with 04 because it was more blatant, and it continues to be manipulated. It's to the point where people have lost faith in the voting system. I feel that the practicing the coup and so forth, it was a soft coup, not a hard one. So the hard one would be violent. But
your point is well made, Shram. And Mark Crispin Miller documented this brilliantly in his book Fooled Again. And I recommend you check it out. Bob Fitrakis and some of his writings over at freepress.net. Yes. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Before the hour, May 11th, I'll be in San Diego, California, KLSD AM 1360, putting on a listener party at the Cosmopolitan Restaurant in San Diego Old Town from 4 to 8 p.m. You can call them at 858-292-2000 for more information. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria, what's happening in Washington?
Hey, Tom. Well, I'd like to start with something personal, if I may.
Please.
which is that it is the 20th anniversary of my arrival in the United States.
Well, happy anniversary, Victoria.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's wonderful. You arrived on May Day, on Beltane.
Yes. Yes, on Workers' Day. Yes.
Indeed. Indeed. And that, yes. And it's a, you know, it's a fine holiday for a redhead from the UK, because that's you know, that's the where Beltane originated, I believe, was, you know, with the indigenous people of that area.
Oh, that's right. No, that's right. No,
it's your tribe.
Over there. Yeah, exactly. My tribe. We did it.
Yep. So we did it. So what's so happy
apart
anniversary.
From that's yeah. The big news. Apart from that, President Bush is in Florida, where he's studiously avoiding making any mention of mission accomplished as he gives an address at CENTCOM, and studiously avoiding making any reference to the supplemental as he makes an address at CENTCOM. So he's trying to avoid making any reference to anything that has any resonance with anybody.
What do you think about this news report that a group of Texas millionaires went up to Washington, D.C. to meet with George W. Bush, and they only had an opportunity to ask him one single question in the 20, 25 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever, that was allotted to spend with them? These were big campaign donors, because he went off on this bizarre rant about how nobody understands him and nobody's walked a mile in his shoes and he's making the best decisions he can and how dare people disagree with him, blah, 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 blah. And several of them were so horrified that they're leaking the story out to the media.
I think it sounds very second-term President Nixon-ish to me.
Yeah, it, very much so. Yeah, the whole bunker mentality thing. It's a little frightening, frankly, when it's the President of the United States.
It is very odd, but I, you know, I really do think there is a real bunker mentality, and I think there is a real sense that everybody is against him. That coupled with a kind of unreality, because I still think that to some extent he is sheltered from the reality of what's going on, and it's only when he gets visits from people from the outside like this, which I don't think happens all that often, that you know, he's really exposed to the idea of, well, these are our concerns. I don't think he sees that very often.
It's incredible to think that somebody could be president of the United States and live in that much of a bubble. But it certainly, you know, history certainly indicates it's happened in the past. So what else, anything else going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, Congress is in session and they're thrashing along. As you know, the supplemental will arrive today. The Congress has managed to get it there. Tony Snow said yesterday in his briefing, his first briefing, that he really didn't understand why it hadn't been possible to get it 1 mile down Pennsylvania Avenue. The Republicans making a big deal of why it hasn't been possible to get it there before. Dana Perino said in the gaggle this morning that this is a cynical publicity stunt why they're doing this today.
Well, sure it is. And good on them for doing it. I mean, this administration wants to blame somebody for a cynical publicity stunt. The last time that they killed the number two guy in Al-Qaeda, the same guy, by the way, he's been killed twice now, was back on February 15th, the very same day it was the first time Congress had ever, you know, issued a strong no vote to George W. Bush. And I mean, and now it's coming out that this time is probably a phony, too.
Well, somebody said in the gym this morning when that came on the news, how many heads of Al-Qaeda are there, somebody said in the gym.
Right. The number two job. You don't want the number two job, I'll tell you. The number two guy, he keeps getting killed over and over and over again. The exact same guy.
His life is Groundhog Day.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, thank you for the report from Washington, D.C., Victoria.
Thank you very much.
Good talking with you. 866-303-2270, our number, Cheryl in Los Angeles. Hey, Cheryl, what's up?
Over and over and over.
Cheryl? Okay, let's go to Dan in San Diego. Cheryl had her radio on. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I wanted to talk about Bernard Goldberg and the whole affirmative action thing, and you and some of the callers covered some of what I was going to say, but I'd like to add that one reason why affirmative action is still necessary is that discrimination, it's not being dealt with as vigorously as it should be. And I mean, some of the things that are still going on, you'd think by the time we'd reach the 21st century, we'd be much farther along. And I would say much of the blame you can lay at Reagan's feet. He fostered this climate of, you know, the pendulum has swung too far, even though it hadn't. And from personal experience, another aspect that often is left out is, you know, the discussion is that affirmative action, it's unfair, you know. Like if you look at the paper, compare the stats on paper, minorities sometimes get an unfair edge. But from personal experience, when I attended college, I did it on a scholarship program, and it was on paper, I probably didn't quite stack up, but at the end of college, I didn't graduate at the bottom of my class or at the bottom of the other people who are on a scholarship program, so I think that gets left out of the argument a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's about giving people an opportunity. I mean, Condoleezza Rice made the comment to CBS News that she felt that being brought in at Stanford University was an attempt by Stanford to bring diversity to the university. In other words, it was an affirmative action program of sorts.
Exactly.
And it was a good thing for her, and it was a good thing for the university.
Not good for the country.
Well, you know,
arguably.
You know, if she'd stayed at Stanford, maybe we'd be in good shape now.
Yeah.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. It's, the reality is that we haven't solved our problems yet, and we'll always need the rest of us to backstop each other. It's about community. It's about being here for each other. It's about the liberal ideals on which this country was founded. That's what we need to be holding up again. 57 minutes past.
No suck-up interviews with big-name politicians. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Should impeachment be on the table? Is the Democratic leadership floating a trial balloon here when Jack Murtha says this to Bob Schieffer on CBS News?
The public has spoken. There's four ways to influence a president. One is popular opinion, the election. Third is impeachment, and fourth is the purge.
Are you seriously talking about contemplating an impeachment of this president?
Bob, what I'm saying, there's four ways to influence a president.
And that's one of them.
Is impeachment, and
that's an option that is on the table.
I'm just saying that's one way to influence a president.
Now, back in 2005. A survey found that a majority of Americans felt that if Bush had concealed the casualty figures for this war, or had concealed the reasons for going to this war, that he should be held accountable by impeachment. And it's interesting to see where this thing is going. Keith Ellison is with us, the congressman, member of Congress from the 5th District of Minnesota. Keith Ellison, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great. Great to have you with us here. Ellison.house.gov, by the way, your website. And
.org, Tom.
What is that, Ellison.org?
Yep, KeithEllison.org.
Oh, okay, KeithEllison.org. Great. Thank you very much. And I'm curious, I have this story here, this op-ed news story. It says impeachment should be on the table. According to you, that you said that impeachment should be on the table. Do you stand with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, on the table, I mean, to me, it's a tactical issue at this point. We're about, you know, working up on about 18 months to go here. And I think that there is ample basis, you know, and whether to proceed or not, I think is fundamentally, you know, tactical, but is there a basis? I think, yeah.
Yeah, it was 33 years ago. 2 weeks ago, that the House Judiciary Committee voted, largely Democrats on the committee, to subpoena Richard Nixon's White House tapes.
Yeah.
And it was 33 years ago, August, just 6-7 months later, that Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee said that they would vote for impeachment. I mean, that it was just a matter of, here's the evidence. Oh, do you think that same process could play out today?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, it could. That doesn't mean that it will. But it certainly could. I mean, you know, look at what we got here. I mean, you know, we see a clear and open violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, you know, an act of Congress that the president violated.
And brags about violating.
And brag, you know, bragging about it, you know, so what? We see, you know, the vice president and president making material misstatements to the public about the intelligence that was relied upon to enter into this war. 3,300 Americans dead later, and 600,000 Iraqis dead, and many, many, many more wounded. I mean, we see this U.S. attorney scandal abuse. I mean, this is a very serious issue. When Americans can't have confidence that the United States justice system is even-handed, that's a real problem. You know, I mean, there are just any number of problems here that I think would amply justify impeachment proceedings. But whether or not we do, I think, is really a question of what the leadership wants to do. You know, but I think that
would be Nancy Pelosi in your case.
But the reality is there a basis for? Yeah, absolutely. There's a basis. It's just a question of does the leadership want to do it or not?
Congressman, educate us about who takes what place, because I've been trying to figure this out and I haven't been able to get a good clean answer to this. If, for example, Dennis Kucinich's bill to impeach Dick Cheney were to happen, if Cheney's impeached, who decides who replaces him?
That's a good question. See, Dennis's bill kind of has caused us all to reengage in some civic lessons. Clearly the speaker is the third most elevated position in the government, but I can't claim that I know for sure that the speaker becomes the vice president. I mean, I think that there could well be, I actually just got to confess ignorance on that one.
Yeah. See, I don't know either. And I've read through the Constitution. I can't make sense of it. I think we both need to talk to a constitutional lawyer.
Right.
But my guess would be that if it looked like Cheney was actually going to be impeached, you'd see a repeat of the Nixon situation, which is Cheney would step down, he would resign, he would decide that his ticker isn't working all that well and he needs a new pacemaker or whatever, and he would resign. And if he resigned, then Bush would appoint his successor. I just can't imagine it happening any way other than that. I don't think that he would allow it to go to a vote in the Senate.
Yeah.
But, you know, because these guys, you know which way the wind is blowing. At a certain point, you don't need a weatherman, as we used to say.
Yeah, but the president has demonstrated a tremendous amount of loyalty to some people who've done an awful job for the American people.
Yeah,
you know,
who can
forget about, Katrina? And, Brownie, how much Brownie was doing a great job. And now he's stuck in there with Rumsfeld for the longest time, even after Abu Ghraib, even after the Guantanamo and all that, and
right.
Even after the faulty intelligence on the war. And now he's hanging in there with Gonzalez, despite the fact that he fired people who were there to discharge their duties as U.S. attorneys. And the big question on that is who were the quote-unquote loyal Bushies who he's keeping around?
Right. Yeah. And that's getting, thicker and thicker and darker and more and more confusing, I guess, murky, whatever the proper phrase is. They're trying to throw so much stuff on top of it. You know, here's another document dump and here's some more information. Oh, it's this. And then so-and-so isn't going to speak. Yeah, it's becoming a mess. Hopefully you guys can untangle this thing and bring the light of day into it. We're talking to Keith Ellison. He's the U.S. Congressman representing the 5th District of Minnesota. And, Congressman, if I understand that last year an impeachment resolution was put forward, in fact, that for a couple of years now, that a former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, has at least written, I mean, he doesn't have the authority in Congress to put one forward, but that there have been impeachment articles offered to Congress, shall we say.
Well, I think the state of Vermont has passed something. There's several other states where
it passed through the Senate.
Yeah, there's stuff that that has been introduced in other states, and I think Cynthia McKinney introduced something.
Right.
But
she was the one who introduced Ramsey Clark's language. That's you're right.
Yeah, and then so it's been sitting around. It is sort of like in the air. But I think that It needs more momentum until it, before it's going
to
happen, quite honestly.
It seems to me that the process is going to be like it played out in Watergate, and that is that one of these investigations, and probably something that Henry Waxman has got his,
yeah,
he's got his teeth into the pant leg of a couple of these guys.
Oh, yeah.
And that one of these investigations, probably Gonzalez Gonzogate here, as
yeah,
Keith Olbermann calls it, one of these investigations is going to lead to such irrefutable evidence that the White House was using federal property, federal, you know, the offices and places of we the people for purely political and partisan purposes, illegally, in violation of a whole variety of laws from the Hatch Act up to the FISA law, for example.
Yeah.
That even the Republicans in Congress will look at it and go, okay, that's indefensible.
Well, a lot of them are jumping off ship on this Gonzalez thing. I mean, you know, I mean, it looked like Orrin Hatch was the only Republican in the Senate who wasn't criticizing Gonzalez pretty harshly. I mean, the rest of them are either somewhere between I'm really mad and disapproved to I'm really mad and disapproved, but I'm not asking for you to quit. You know, I mean, it's, it got rough over there for Gonzalez in the Senate. And, 71 times he said he just couldn't remember, which is pretty shameful. But the thing is that, I think that, you know, if the public feels like this is the right thing to do, they need to write their legislators and tell them that. I mean.
Right. Or call them. You can call your member of Congress at
225-3121.
Congressman, we have, you know, less than a minute left here. I'm curious if, in your mind, Jack Murtha's mentioning the word impeachment a couple of times to Bob Schieffer on national television, was Nancy Pelosi and Jack Murtha, who are close friends, floating a trial balloon, or was it just a fluke?
You know, I'm not even going to guess on that one. I will say that both of those are two great leaders who care about the American people. And if I may, as we go out, you know, I haven't had a chance to talk with you before, but I want to tell you that your book, Screwed, was influential on me. And I want to talk to you about economic justice one day in the future.
Oh, well, thank you. Let's absolutely make an appointment to do that.
Yeah, we're introducing a bill on universal default, you know, on credit cards this on Thursday. So
that's great.
That's in the spirit of what you're talking about.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, and great talking with you, Congressman Keith Ellison. KeithEllison.org is website, and great talking with the congressman. We'll be back 16 minutes past the hour. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
2 minutes past the hour at Jim Turr from BlueCanyonSatire.com. Oh, my goodness. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat up at the top of the page. You can also find a link to Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. My book, which I just got a plug from a member of Congress. That was really sweet. Wayne in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Well, I've done some studying on the vice presidential succession.
Great.
And what the 22nd Amendment says is that the president will nominate the successor, but the successor has to be confirmed by a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate.
Right, but I'm looking it up as we're speaking here. I thought that that was only in the event of the death or disability of the vice president.
I think it's in the absence of a vice president.
Okay, because I didn't think that the impeachment. Agnew resigned, and
they did the same process with Gerald Ford.
Agnew resigned and Nixon resigned, and so in both cases there wasn't a constitutional process. There was simply the appointment by the superior, by the president.
No, he had to be confirmed.
You're right. Yeah, he was confirmed. So then, in other words, what you're suggesting is if Kucinich's proposed impeachment resolution was if Cheney was impeached by the Senate and the House and a trial was held in the Senate and he was convicted,
yes,
then and removed from office, then Bush would have to appoint a replacement, but that appointment would have to be approved by 2/3 of the House and Senate.
No,
is that right?
A majority of the House and a majority of the Senate. So again, I can just hardly imagine Bush nominating somebody that would actually pass a majority of this House. We could conceivably be without a vice president for the rest of his term. And I'm not sure that would be a bad thing.
Yeah, in which case, really, the Speaker of the House would acquire probably a little more power. Although
he'd be next in line.
Who becomes president of the Senate in that case?
I think Bush is unimpeachable while Cheney's there. And I think that would make impeachment of Bush a whole lot more likely if Nancy Pelosi was next in line, or if Bush nominated somebody that was acceptable both to the House and the Senate. That would basically put him right on the impeachment block, which he's not there now with Cheney being the replacement.
Well, interesting. Wayne, thanks for the heads up and for the tip. I'll tell you, we've got the smartest listeners on earth here on this program. Jerry in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
I was going to make the same point. That's the Bayh Amendment from Birch Bayh in Indiana. It came up under the Watergate thing. But, you know, I'm not so sure.
Wait a second. What's the Bayh Amendment?
The amendment he was reading to you, that was by Birch Bayh. It's called the Bayh Amendment.
No, we're talking about the 22nd Amendment of the Constitution,
right,
which was passed back in 1800-something or other.
Well, there's, maybe I'm wrong. There's a Bayh Amendment that selects the vice president. Can you check that?
Yeah, it's Congressional Salaries is the 27th Amendment. It's the one that I've got in this little book. And then before that, suffrage of 18-year-olds and presidential disability and secession, the 25th Amendment, ratified in 1967. Is that the one from Birch Bayh?
No, this would have been during the Watergate period.
Yeah. Huh. Well, apparently it didn't make it into the Constitution, or at least not the copy I have.
This says,
in the case of removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president should become president. Whenever there's a vacancy in the office of the vice president, the president shall nominate a vice president who shall take office upon confirmation by a majority vote of both houses of Congress. Okay, so I think that's the one. So it's the 25th Amendment that what's-his-name was talking about.
Yeah, well, what was the date on that?
Wayne. 67.
Okay, that's the one. But, you know, I'm not so sure that'd be a good idea to remove Cheney. I'll tell you why, because then the Roe thing will kick in, and if we then go ahead and impeach Bush, we're going to be dealing with an incumbent. Also, it'll take the steam out of these inquiries. My theory would be to not impeach either one of them in that war and keep the inquiries going so we went into the election with all the dirty wash hanging out and put that bunch away forever.
Because if either one of them are impeached, then the possibility is that they would simply put Giuliani or McCain or whoever is going to be the presumptive, you know, or whatever, you know.
What if they bring up Thompson, the actor?
Yeah, right, exactly.
And
Fred Thompson.
He's vice
put him
president.
In and yeah, that's right. And now he's got a leg up in the election. Yeah, good point, Jerry. You know, well said. Thank you very much. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room where I'm going to go hang out for the next few minutes while I'm listening to what's going on the radio. Stick around.
The Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
moves on the grindstone. Work hard every day. I might get a little tired on the weekend. After I draw my pay, I'll go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew. I drank a little beer that evening, sang a little bit of these working man blues.
34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270. Gene in San Francisco, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I have a question for you to set the understanding of it. My understanding of the rules of impeachment are that they were very genteel. They were about people who really wanted to sort of figure things out, and that's sort of what the rules of engagement were. Like that in that period of history. They were genteel, even in warfare.
I think Andrew Johnson would disagree with you.
Well, I'm talking about the 1700s. Even the Napoleonic Wars, the soldiers would line up and shoot at each other outside the city.
And the British Parliament had to pass a law in 1815 called the Law to Provide for the Deportment and Imprisonment of Napoleon Bonaparte. Because it would have otherwise been a violation of his habeas corpus rights. They had to specifically pass a law to violate habeas corpus in the case of this one guy that they had captured on the battlefield.
Well, that's what I mean. It was more genteel that way.
And
the Republicans have changed that now with the impeachment of Clinton.
Although, I would suggest that it happened also to Andrew Johnson because he was a Democrat who was the vice president and was roundly unpopular. But I think
my concern is can we find an alternative for impeachment? It might not work right now, but I think that when they destroy records of government, when they refuse to release public records, or they conduct an outright cover up. That these should be made crimes so heinous that even if the perpetrators destroy the evidence, they can still be removed.
Well, the problem is if there's no evidence, how can you prove a crime?
But you can prove it because they destroyed the evidence. They destroyed the paper trail. They conducted a cover up, and I think that in itself is enough.
Yeah, it wouldn't be enough in a criminal court, but it would be enough
a crime to do that.
Only if you can demonstrate that it happened. They would say that they were just routinely deleting emails. They're not destroying evidence. They're just routinely deleting emails. Everybody does it, don't you? I mean, we all do. That's the position that they're already taking by and large. And I think that to a large extent, the remedy. For this is the remedy that we've had this conversation with Bernie Sanders before. The remedy is at the ballot box. The remedy is people getting out there and getting active and saying we are so totally grossed out by this that never again kind of thing. And that's where I think that ultimately it's going to probably go. And that's frankly where it went after Nixon left. And it's just a shame that Gerry Ford pardoned Nixon. I mean, he set such a terrible precedent that people would not be held accountable down the line. Hilda in Manhattan. Hey, Hilda, what's on your mind today?
Hey, first of all, I'd like to say how brilliant you are. I've never known anyone with such depth of knowledge. I'm going to the Constitution at the back and the oath of affirmation that they swear they will, to the best of their ability, I guess Bush doesn't have much ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, that would seem on Article 2,
Article 2, Section 8.
Right. And
Section 1, Paragraph 8.
Yeah. Why am I talking to you? You've got to hold the answers, which is really delightful.
Sorry, Hilda.
No, I just feel frustrated. I'm an activist, and I always like to think that I have something to contribute. Listening to you, I get a lot of...
You do. And your point was?
Well, my point, I think we have enough evidence for impeachment.
Let me state what I think I heard you say, Hilda, and that is that because really one of the major parts of the job description of the president is Article 2 of the Constitution defines what the executive branch shall be, and paragraph 8 says, before he entered the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that because Bush has failed to defend the Constitution, in fact, he has defied and some would say destroyed the Constitution by throwing out First Amendment rights of free speech with free speech zones, Fourth Amendment rights of privacy with wiretapping individuals, Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination by torturing people, and Sixth Amendment and Seventh and Eighth Amendment rights, and Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth, of trial by jury and speedy trial and due process, and the ability to make bail in the case of American citizens like Jose Padilla, that he has spit upon the Constitution, and therefore he should be held accountable, whether it's in the court of public opinion or whether it's in the court of the House and the Senate in an impeachment process. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, well, I just think that the president, vice president, all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office for impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. I think what Bush and Cheney have done fits high crimes and misdemeanors, although misdemeanors is a very... It's confusing to me, but I think what they did against the Constitution is a high crime.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Hilda, and thank you. Very well said. Let's see here. Mike in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for all you and everybody in America does. Several years ago, some Democrats were saying, let's not impeach Bill Clinton. He screwed up. He messed up. Let's censure him.
Right.
It would seem as though the threshold for censuring would be lower than impeachment, and you might get several Republicans to sign on. And this makes a statement about this administration before they skedaddle out, leaving their mess behind, and could, like I say, get a lot of support. And the reasons could go back to the very beginning of the Bush administration. One of the things is scandal and incompetence overload. There, every day something has hit the papers about this administration since they took office. And with our short memories, we forget about it.
Yeah,
but if somebody made a list of all those things and said, okay, these qualify for censure, wouldn't you sign on for that, Mr. Republican? And you got the Democrats, and at least something is done. Because impeachment, even as Murtha says, won't happen.
Yeah. Well, actually, he didn't. I'm not sure that he said that. He said that it's one way to get the president's attention,
right,
and he
right.
kind of
sorry,
stopped
yeah.
what he was saying at that point. But yeah, I suspect you're right, and I think that that's probably a very good suggestion is censure of some sort. The key in my mind is, and I think that probably I'm as guilty of this as anybody else, is that at a certain level we're putting the cart before the horse. That first we have to, even though you can make the case, and I think it can be made very clearly that by confessing in public on national news in a press conference that he had violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which provides for 2 years in prison for each violation by any federal officer, which includes the President of the United States, that Bush has confessed to a crime. But nonetheless, even, you know, setting that aside, that really what is necessary is a mini trial in one of the committees of Congress where the crimes just are so obvious and so unmistakable. And impeachment is almost like it has become a focus for our anger or our upset or our grief, really, about what's been done to this country and what's been done to our Constitution, rather than any kind of practical political strategy. And the practical political strategy is to point out what crimes they are and prosecute them specifically and hold them accountable in court or in the court of the ballot box. Mike, I think you're spot on and well said. Charles in Everett, Washington. Hey, Charles, welcome to the program.
Hi there. You got to like a San Francisco station with a name like the Quake.
Yeah.
You kind of hashed this over. You've detailed that the bar was set so low for impeachment that the transgressions, as you've listed, of the current administration certainly qualify. But I think that Bob Schieffer and the rest of the media sort of blew Murtha's comment kind of out of proportion, and it is not practical. There is only so much political energy right now, and you know, they know that even Murtha and certainly the Democratic leadership, which I'm not sure he's actually a part of, but I sure recognize him as a leader. I think they know that too. So they're responding to a lot of us that are very frustrated. We're impatient in America, and we see if we could do that for the mess on the blue dress, good Lord, why can't we do something for this?
Yeah, yeah, good point. So, thank you, Charles. Eric in Modesto, California. What's up, Eric?
Hey, Tom. I was just wondering, I'm reading a book called Hubris. I don't know if you've read it.
I have it, and I've spent some time with it. I haven't read it, you know, word to word, cover to cover. In fact, the author, whose name is escaping me at the moment, was a guest on this program about 6-8 months ago, a year ago when it came out.
Yeah. Well, it basically lays out the spin and the telling of the Iraq War.
Or one of the two authors, as I recall.
I was wondering, what is the Republican response to this? I mean, how can they sit back and say that the things that Bush and the cabinet have done
Well, you have two Republicans now who have voted with the Democrats in you know, with this war resolution, this Iraq war funding resolution. So I think the and some in the House as well. I think the wall is starting to crack.
Okay, are they just denying it? I mean, for the most part, like more conservatives. I heard actually the enemy this morning, Rush Limbaugh, said that Bush never linked Al Qaeda to Iraq or something like that.
Oh, really? That's great. You know, I heard the Tony Snow said that as well, that that there was no relationship between Iraq and the Bush had never made that association. I'll share the audio with you right after this, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program, fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Mayday.
I never died, said he.
Joe Hill, the hero of labor, executed in Salt Lake City, set up on a murder charge and shot by a firing squad. Crank that back up, Alex.
More than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die.
And it's a metaphor for the labor movement, really. You know, Joe Hill and the whole story of Joe Hill. And it's just a remarkable thing. Today, May 1st, traditionally Workers' Day, in addition to Beltane and, you know, May Day, and the beginning of spring, a Sabbath for Wiccans and a holiday for laborers. And, of course, the conservatives have also made it National Law and Order Day or National Law Day or whatever they call it these days. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, you're live and on the air listening on KTRC. Hey, Roy, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I thought I'd just call and give you kind of an update on what's been happening here in New Mexico.
Okay.
The state convention was this weekend, and I am happy to report that the progressives are in solid position with the party. Are we in control? I don't know. But we elected a terrific guy as the chairman. As one of my friends has said, we no longer have to fight the Democratic Party to get things done. We only have to bring things up, discuss it, work out a plan to implement it.
That's great. And you no longer have to fight the Democratic Party. You are the Democratic Party.
We are the Democratic Party. And I had a friend of mine that was her first time as a state delegate. She said she had a ball. I didn't go, but she had a ball. She said it was an outstanding victory. The organization of the meeting itself just flowed. There was lots of good debate. And the old-timers and the conservatives and the big business types just got pushed off to the side. Every elected position, every position that was up for election, got captured by progressives.
Yeah.
Now, they're still the old timers. They're still the old movers and shakers, and they're still the old money men. But they know we're here.
Yeah.
And
well, good on you, Roy, because you're one of the people who helped make it happen. And I just tip of the hat to you.
Well, you know, I mean, it wasn't me. I was up here in one of these little counties, the guys in Burnley. It was a lot of little guys.
Yeah, that's
getting
that's
together, the... making things happen. Greg Pallas was out here Sunday night, and unfortunately, I wasn't able to get up to see him either.
Yeah, he was here a week or so ago here in Portland.
He recognized a bunch of the, because a bunch of the voting folks were in the audience, and he had them stand up, and they gave them a standing ovation because they are the ones that took back the voting machines in New Mexico a couple years ago.
And the only state to have done so far as I know.
And it is, the whole purpose of the call, Tom, is just to keep educating, motivating, and agitating. Let's get there out there. Let's take our party back. Like Terry Riley said, this buddy of mine that was real active in the voter drive, he said, what a bright new world we have. Let's go out and fix something.
There you go. Well said. Right. Thanks a lot. Good talking with you. Thanks so much for your service to party and country. Patrice in Kansas City, Kansas. Hey, Patrice.
Hi, Tom. I'm happy to talk to you. You're one of my heroes. I'm going to connect this to the impeachment discussion by saying that the Democrats might as well get hung for wolves as for lambs. And an example of that is the fact that you listen to the media, as I have all day today, and every reference to the veto of the appropriations bill, it does not include the fact that that timeline is non-binding. And
right.
It makes the Democrats look like much more like they're interfering when that fact is not included in there. Now,
yeah, there's actually two facts. One is that the timeline is not binding, and the second is that right now Bush has enough funding to continue doing everything he needs to do or wants to do, and frankly can pull money out of his back pocket for better Humvees between now and the end of August.
Yeah, so the Democrats dancing around this, afraid of how they're going to be perceived, is a big mistake because they will be hung for sheep. So they might as well be a wolf, you know? I mean, they might as well go after it because they cannot do the right thing for as far as the Bush administration is concerned. They're going to get attacked anyway, so they might as well do the right thing.
Yeah, amen. Well said, Patrice. Thank you. Ed in Vancouver, Washington.
Thanks for taking my call. The last lady was spot on. There's an old saying about if you set out to kill the king, you better get it done. I think,
or as Sancho Trafficante said, or Carlos Marcello, one or the other. I think it was Trafficante said when Jimmy Hoffa came and said he wanted to kill Bobby Kennedy, and Trafficante said no. He said you don't cut off the tail. He said then the dog will just turn around and bite you. You cut off its head, and that's when they hatched the plot to kill Jack Kennedy. So
well,
in any case, I even
hate to use those metaphors. It's a little bit scary. But anyway,
I agree.
I think you're being a little bit narrow on your requirements or criteria for impeachment. I think in federal law, I'm not a lawyer. I'll preface by saying that. But I think there's something about malfeasance and dereliction of duty. And those may fall more into military law, but he is the chief military guy, too.
But the Constitution specifies for federal offices the terms for impeachment, and it's treason, high crimes, and misdemeanors. So I get your point, Ed.
The high crimes and misdemeanors, though.
Yeah, well, that's the point. It's equally vague, and so we could look at the broad sweep of things that these guys have been up to and go for it. On the other hand, I think that moving ahead is there's a lot to be said for moving ahead as well. Hey, tomorrow I'll be challenging conservative Bruce Ledowitz on his new book, American Religious Democracy: Coming to Terms with the End of Secular Politics. Say what? And Are Everything You Know Is Wrong? Troubled teen industry. And don't ever forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.